When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Released just 3 years after the iconic Raiders of the Lost Ark, this action-packed prequel takes us back to the 1930s, where we find our intrepid archaeologist, Indiana Jones, in a web of peril when he becomes entangled with a ruthless cult hell-bent on capturing the mystical Sankara stones and enslaving an entire village. Joined by reluctant lounge singer Willie Scott and the wisecracking Short Round, Dr. Jones battles his way through treacherous jungles, dark catacombs, and a heart-stopping minecart chase that had audiences gripping the edge of their seats. So grab your fedora, dust off your leather jacket, and prepare for an exotic dinner you'll never forget as Nicholas Pepin and I discuss Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom from 1984 on this episode of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast.
If adventure has a name, it must be Indiana Jones.
This is serious!
From Steven Spielberg and George Lucas, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom.
Don't believe me. You will, Dr. Jones.
Hello, movie viewers and movie lovers. My name is Tim Williams, creator and host of the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. On each episode, I'm joined by an 80s flick-loving guest co-host to talk about one of the great and sometimes not-so-great movies from the 1980s. From blockbusters to cult classics to lesser-known treasures we discovered on cable TV or the now-defunct video rental stores from our childhood. No matter which 80s flick we choose for each episode, we have a lot of fun sharing first-time watch memories, discussing our favorite iconic scenes, and even learning some behind-the-scenes stories about the cast and crew along the way. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe and follow 80s Flick Flashback on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever your favorite podcast platform is. And while you're there, leave us a stellar written review and a 5-star rating. You can also support the show by following us on our social media pages. Just search for 80s Flick Flashback on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And don't forget to check out our website, 80sflickflashback.com, as well. If you want to take your support to the next level, you can become a financial partner for less than $10 a month. The link to financially support the podcast is located in our episode show notes. And while you're there, be sure to check out more fun facts and behind-the-scenes trivia we just weren't able to fit into today's episode. Thanks for listening. Now, on with the show. All right, welcome in, everybody, and so glad to have you for our very first episode of our Summer of Sequels series. So excited for this series that we're doing on the podcast and excited to talk about Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. But let me introduce my guest co-host. You know him, you love him. He's a favorite here at the podcast from Pop Culture Roulette. Please say hello to Nicholas Pepin. How you doing, Nicholas?
I'm good. I think I already know how you're doing. I had that whole intro there already.
Right, yeah. Right.
Oh, I'm ready to join in on the fun of the Summer of Sequels.
Yes, yes. And you are a Indian. I know you made comments like you'd love to talk anything Indiana Jones. So you were game when I mentioned it to you. So yep. Wonderful to have you on this one. I do want to mention, so for those of you that have been with the podcast for a while, I wanted to start the Summer of Sequels with this sequel, because the very first episode we did on this podcast was Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is still currently, at this point of recording, it is still number two in our most listened to episodes. But I will say that if this is your first time listening to the podcast and you want to go back and listen to that episode, I want to warn you, it is not the easiest episode to listen to, because when I started the podcast, I learned things later that I didn't learn until I'd already started, but I should have done like a couple of, you know, practice runs of episodes before I was just like, I'm going to start a podcast. I'm going to record and put it out there and see what happens. So, you know, I was learning how to the pace of the show. I talked a whole lot. I had way more notes than I probably needed to. All of saying all that to say, we've gotten better. Hopefully if you go back and listen to that episode, you can see, or you can hear that the podcast has gotten better, with better equipment, better editing, all that kind of stuff. So, but to honor the first episode, we're starting off this, summer of sequels with Temple of Doom, which I will say from the offset is not my favorite sequel of the franchise.
No, it is not.
Yeah. but I figured we'd go to the second one and not jump to the third one, which is the one I'd rather talk about. But anyway, moving on. Well, let's jump right in. Nicholas, when did you see Temple of Doom for the very first time?
You know, again, I think I say this every time I do an episode with you. I don't know. I'm guessing it would have been in the early 90s when, like, because I mean, when the Last Crusade came out in what, 89?
Yeah.
So it would have been around that time when, because like Young Indiana Jones was on TV.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, the home video being what it was, I'm guessing that this is a Temple of Doom would have been one that my parents probably would have been a little hesitant to let me watch. But I guarantee you we watched it at some point, because I know that we love Raiders. I know I watched Last Crusade a bunch. So there's no way I didn't see Temple of Doom. We just, like, and we'll get through, as we talk about it, we'll get to it. Like, it's just, it's not as bad as I remember.
Yeah,
like I was going to say rewatching the
same thing.
Rewatching it. And I don't know if that's because the specter of Crystal Skull is hanging out.
Yeah, anything's better than that one for sure.
Or it's just, you know, nostalgia has a way of softening things. But it's still, you know, it's not as good as Raiders. It's not as good as Last Crusade. But it's still, there's still a lot of fun in this movie.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I was going to say it was much more entertaining watching it again, and I had not watched it in a long time. We'll get to that too, but yeah, I did see this one in the theater because we had seen, I want to say we saw Raiders of the Lost Ark in the theater, but I specifically remember going to see this one in the theater as the family, like on a Saturday afternoon, and I remember the conversations being had when we left, like my parents being like, we really didn't expect it to be like that. It was really, you know, dark, you know, the cult stuff and the, you know, live heart coming out of a man's chest. Like, they were like, are you guys okay? And I was like, man, I thought it was cool, whatever, you know. And my sister was older than me, and she was, you know, she just thought, in, you know, Harrison Ford was hot, so, you know, she wasn't too concerned about it. But yeah, it's funny thinking about it now. It's like that it didn't traumatize me in any way. Like, I wasn't like overly scared about it. And I think because had it been the first one, like if they had done this story instead of Raiders first, it probably would have been a little bit tougher to take in. But because, I mean, you'd seen a melting face in Raiders, so I mean, that's
right.
Still,
yeah.
You know, that's not so kid friendly either.
No. And you know, I don't know where you're going to get to it in the notes, but you talk about seeing it as a kid, and you have to remember that for some reason this was PG.
Yeah,
but that's because this one and Gremlins, and I'm sure other movies, but those two
specifically, yeah,
are the ones that they always point to as going, that's why we have PG-13 now.
Yeah,
because that exact experience that you had with your family, a lot of other families had, where they're like, "Oh, Raiders was so cool," and they went to see this one, and they're like, "Oh, wait, what was that? Shield Monkey Brains?"
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was like, I don't think he was threatened with an R rating, but I think he was getting some flack from, you know, not parents, but flack from somewhere about, do we tame it down, or can we, it's not quite horror as an R, but it is a little hard for younger kids. And so when Steven Spielberg tells a story, he says that he actually called the president of MPAA and said, hey, can we get like another, rating? And I think he said originally it was like PG-14 or maybe PG-13, somewhere around there. He said the guy was like, oh, we'll take it into advisement. And then like a month later, they were announcing we now have this new rating called PG-13. So he likes to say that he was the one that kind of got them to do it. But I read other places where they said it had been something they had been working on since like the late 70s. So it'd been something they had already been thinking about doing. But yeah, I think Gremlins for sure, Raiders and Temple of Doom were very much one of the reasons why they went ahead and changed the rating at that point.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And it makes sense. Especially yeah. Gremlins. And, I know you did that one.
Mm-hmm. So. And we talked about that as well. Like I wanted my daughter to watch it, and this has been a couple of years ago. So she was around 10, which is around the same time I watched it as a kid. And she was fine, the first part. And then once it started getting kind of dark, she was like, nah, I'm not ready for this. And I was like, yeah, I kind of forgot how it really jumps to very like much like a horror movie about 40 minutes in. So yeah. And that's kind of how this one is. This one kind of starts off kind of fun. And, the musical number at the beginning, which is so kind of out of place. And then, but you have that kind of typical indie chase scene, he has an artifact or whatever that somebody else wants. And then once they get to the palace, it becomes a totally different type of movie at that point.
Well, again, I'm probably jumping the route here, but I know that Spielberg and Lucas really liked James Bond.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And they loved the 1930s serials.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So they clearly combined their love of James Bond and the 30s serials mm-hmm. by having this over-the-top musical number.
Right, right.
And then a cold open that basically had nothing to do with the rest of the movie. It was because that's almost every James Bond movie is mm-hmm. that you've got this thing happening.
Yep.
That's nothing more than just a way to start the actual story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I guess Bond also has the musical number, but that tends to be the animated credits. But
right, right.
But this one was Kate Capshaw singing in half Mandarin. But
mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So we'll get into it. Let's finish our initial questions. But this is what we do. This is the podcast. This is what you're tuning in for. So how long had it been since you rewatched? I know we both said we enjoyed it more this time. Had it been a long time since you watched this one?
I don't know how long it's been. It's probably been in the last 10 to 15 years mm-hmm. that I've watched it. Cause I know at some point they put out a DVD set of the three
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and then I bought it and I definitely rewatched them all then, but they put out a Lego Indiana Jones game.
Okay.
It was the three movies. And then they did like Lego Indiana Jones 2 where they did like the three movies again, but kind of condensed. And mm-hmm. added in the Crystal Skull as like a bigger part of it.
Okay.
So it's, they do the movie almost identical to, the game, but then they just make it humorous. So like you spend a lot of time with the game and doing the scenes in the movie mm-hmm. and you tend to forget like, wait, I didn't actually watch the movie. I just spent, 36 hours playing it.
Right. Right. That's cool. Yeah, it's been probably the same for me. Like I remember like within the last 13 years, obviously, because it was when I was still living in Jacksonville, that I think before it was Paramount, whatever was before Paramount Network on cable, one of those channels, they did like a Indiana Jones marathon on a Saturday. And I caught like the middle of Raiders. And I watched all of that. And then like Temple of Doom was next. Like, oh, I think I'm just going to go ahead and watch this one. And I'm pretty sure I watched it then. But this was the first time I've really sat down and watched it from beginning to end without commercials. The regular, not that it's really that much edited for TV, but like just in its original uncut, no commercials, interruptions of kind of format. I was very thankful. I have the DVD set still. I think I have the 4 one that has Crystal Skull with it, or I bought it separate
I don't remember, but I have all four of them on DVD. But right before, you know, the end of May, Disney Plus put all of them on Disney Plus, all the Indiana Jones movies and the young Indiana Jones TV show, which I'm going to go back and watch at some point. So they had it in 4K. So I was able to watch it on my TV in 4K. I was like, cool. I have to go buy the Blu-ray. I can watch it on Disney Plus now, which was kind of nice.
I was going to go down to the basement and get it, but then like right as you were like, hey, do you want to do it? Disney, mm-hmm. you know, you were like, okay. And then Disney Plus was like, we put them all on. And I'm like, now I don't have to go to the basement.
Right.
All right.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's like, and it's crazy because my, you know, my DVD copy is literally under the TV. I could have went down, put it in my Xbox and watched it that way, but I was like, nah, I'll be all right. And then even for more shame, I watched the behind the scene features on YouTube.
Yeah, I can't tell you how many movies I watch on streaming that I know I own on DVD. I just don't want to go downstairs and get it.
Yeah. I know it is. It makes me mad sometimes because I'll forget what I have on Blu-ray or DVD and I'll be looking for it on streaming and I'll spend like 20 minutes trying to find out where it is and I'll be like, dude, you have it on a disc. Just go get it and put it in the thing. It's like, oh, yeah, I forget that I have that one.
And now these messages.
Welcome to the Summer of Superman. Get ready for an electrifying journey through the iconic tale that shook the world of superheroes three decades ago. Moving Panels presents a special series dedicated to the monumental event that changed the course of comic book history, the death and return of Superman. Join us as we dive deep into the pages of one of the most impactful stories ever told, exploring the Man of Steel's ultimate sacrifice and his triumphant resurrection. But that's just the beginning. Experience the thrilling animated movies, The Death of Superman and Reign of the Superman, that brought this epic story to life on the screen. In each episode, we will dissect every chapter, dissecting the emotions and going behind the scenes of this unforgettable saga and its animated counterparts. From the impact on Superman's friends and allies to the worldwide mourning that ensued, Moving Panels will leave no stone unturned, delivering a comprehensive exploration of this milestone in comic book history. So grab your cape and join us this summer for the Summer of Superman on Moving Panels, where we honor the 30th anniversary of the death and return of Superman, episode by episode, reliving the awe, the heartache, and the undying legacy of the man who inspired millions. Don't miss a single installment of this thrilling podcast event. Subscribe now to Moving Panels on your favorite podcast platform and be a part of the Summer of Superman.
Now playing on a cell phone near you, a show for all the manly men out there, where guys talk about their favorite movies and what they can teach us about being a man, featuring the coolest guests.
Murder somebody is not like killing an ant.
The most gratifying laughs.
It's Tombstone, what can I say?
And a fresh take on movies like you've never heard before.
This will be the thing that gets written on his proverbial tombstone.
We aren't here to criticize the movies you love, but to praise them for how they apply to our lives as husbands, fathers, and really all men in general. So buckle up your seatbelts, because Manly Movies is here. Subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or your other favorite podcast catcher. And remember, man up.
What seems to be the problem, pal?
There's just so much pain in the world, so many issues. I don't think I can bear it.
Well, friendo, it sounds like you could use a dose of Pop Culture Roulette.
Pop Culture Roulette? What's that? Some sort of pop culture-themed podcast or something?
That's right, sonny boy. When hope seems far, dive into some PCR!
But I already get my entertainment news from Variety.
Huh, that's pretty good. If you're a chucklehead, PCR gives you news you need, condensed, unfiltered, and raw, from three nerds who know a little something about something.
Wow, okay, sign me up.
That's the spirit. Pop Culture Roulette. New episodes every Monday, available on all major podcast directories.
All right, well, let's jump into story origin and pre-production. We've kind of talked a little bit about it already. This is going to be a little long, and I tried to shorten it. But there's some interesting things in here. So we'll try to take some breaks as we go. So it's not just me talking for the next 15 minutes. But here we go. According to director Steven Spielberg, George Lucas approached him for Raiders of the Lost Ark with the condition that if Spielberg directed the first film, he would have to direct a trilogy. But it turned out that Lucas did not have three stories in mind when he pitched the idea, so the other stories had to be made up. Both men attributed to the film's darker tone compared to the first film to their personal moods following their breakups. I think Lucas was going through a divorce and Spielberg had just broke up with his girlfriend at the time. Additionally, Lucas believed the film had to have a dark theme because of how Empire Strikes Back had was the dark second act of the Star Wars trilogy, which I think is horrible, you know, reasoning, because Empire was like is telling one long story, or, you know, Star Wars was telling one long story. Indiana Jones wasn't. And they even set this one before the first one. So you're not even telling the second part of a story. You're telling a story from before Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, I mean, to go back to the James Bond analogy, I mean, there's 26, 27 James Bond movies, and you can watch them in any order you want, not really, except for the last few, but that's another matter.
Right.
But I mean, for the most part, you can watch any order because it doesn't matter because they don't really take place in it. So you don't have to watch, like, if you wanted to watch a proper timeline, you could watch it, but it doesn't. None of the movies really build off of each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it doesn't matter. Exactly. So I like this quote from Spielberg. He said, "The danger in making a sequel is that you can never satisfy everyone. If you give people the same movie with different scenes, they say you weren't more original. But if you give them the same character in another fantastic adventure, but with a different tone, you risk disappointing the other half of the audience who just wanted a carbon copy of the first film with a different girl and a different bad guy. So you win and you lose both ways," which I think we've seen that with a lot of franchises over the years where you try to go in a different direction and people are upset. You do this carbon copy of the same last movie, people are upset. So you're not going to please everybody. So to avoid repeating the use of Nazis as villains, Lucas decided to set the film in an earlier year than the first. Initially, Spielberg wanted to bring back Marion Ravenwood with Abner Ravenwood as a possible character as well. Lucas developed the story, including an opening chase scene with Indiana Jones on a motorcycle on the Great Wall of China, followed by the discovery of a lost world with a hidden valley inhabited by dinosaurs. Additionally, the Monkey King was considered as the plot device, but Chinese authorities refused permission for them to film in the country, so a different setting had to be required. Lucas had written a film treatment that included a haunted castle in Scotland, but Spielberg felt it was too similar to Poltergeist, so the setting transformed into a demonic temple in India. During the early stages of development, Lucas proposed ideas for a film involving a religious cult that practiced child slavery, black magic, and ritual human sacrifice. Lawrence Kasdan, who had written the Raiders of the Lost Ark script, was initially asked to write this script, but declined due to his distaste for the proposed storyline and the overall dark tone of the film. Lucas then hired Hilliard Huck and Gloria Katz, who also wrote Howard the Duck, by the way, who were knowledgeable about Indian culture, to write the script. The writer spent 4 days at Skywalker Ranch discussing the story with Lucas and Spielberg, with the initial plot revolving around Indy's decision to return a stolen item to a village and the film starting in China and moving to India. Lucas was focused on getting through meetings while Spielberg paid more attention to the visual aspects of the film. Lucas's initial idea for Indiana's sidekick was a virginal young princess, but Huck and Katz and Spielberg disliked the idea, and I'm glad they did. Short Round came from a character with the same name in the 1951 movie The Steel Helmet, written and directed by journalist and military veteran Sam Fuller. The character in this movie was a young Asian boy who followed the main character closely, like Ki-Hoo-Yuan followed Harrison Ford's Indiana Jones. Steven Spielberg came up with the idea to use the name based on the similarities of the characters. Anything to add so far?
No.
Or responses?
Not yet. I'm sure I've got some coming.
But. Yeah. All right. After this, Lucas handed Huck and Katz a 20-page treatment in May of 1982 titled Indiana Jones, the Temple of Death, to adapt into a screenplay. There were scenes such as a fight scene in Shanghai, the escape from the airplane, and the minecart chase came from earlier scripts of Raiders of the Lost Ark. In Raiders, the headpiece for the Staff of Ra was originally conceived to be in two pieces, with the first piece in the Museum of General Hawk, a Japanese allied Chinese warlord in Shanghai. Jones was planned to steal that piece and then use a giant gong as a shield as General Hawk fired a submachine gun at him during this escape, much like the final moments in Club Obi-Wan. Kasdan said that was too expensive to produce for the earlier movie. After that, Jones was to fly to Nepal to find Marion and the second piece. In flight, he falls asleep and all the other passengers on the plane bail and parachute to safety, leaving him to escape alone using an inflatable raft to slide down a Himalayan slope to Marion's bar. Kasdan said this was cut because it interrupted the story flow and was, quote, too unbelievable, a complaint leveled by some critics at the finished scene in this movie, which I will say that is probably the most unrealistic of all the scenes of all the movies, is them surviving by floating on a raft that hits a mountain.
Yeah, what is it? Raft is a parachute to toboggan to an actual raft. Totally ridiculous, but it follows in tradition with Indiana Jones, because we do get a fridge coming in Crystal Skull.
This is true. But yeah, so it is interesting that they did have some of the scenes in this were things that they wanted to do in the first movie but couldn't, and so they just found ways to kind of work it into the story of this one, which some worked, some didn't. So Lucas, Spielberg, Katz, and Hoyt were concerned how to keep the audience interest while explaining the cult. Huck and Katz proposed a tiger hunt, but Spielberg said, "There's no way I'm going to stay in India long enough to shoot a tiger hunt." They eventually decided on a dinner scene involving eating bugs, monkey brains, and the like. Katz said Steve and George both still react like children, so their idea was to make it as gross as possible. The second draft of the script was completed in September. Originally, Captain Blumbert, Charter Lal, and Maharaja had more significant roles to play. However, some scenes, including a dog fight and those featuring characters turning into zombies after drinking the Kali blood, were eventually cut. Additionally, during pre-production, the title was changed from Temple of Death to Temple of Doom. Huck and Katz worked on final rewrites for the shooting script from March to April of 1983. Interestingly, Huck and Katz revealed that Harrison Ford ended up taking many of the one-liners that were initially written for Short Round, which I thought was interesting. So that's the making of the movie, or how it came to be.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure in their heads, and if we were to sit down and talk with them, mm-hmm. it would make a lot more sense on how they went from China to India by mm-hmm. long route, you know. But, yeah. I think what we got is way better than what they started with.
Yeah. It's one of those things where, especially in sequels too, you see it where, like in this case, where they had things they wanted to do in the first movie that they couldn't do, but they liked the ideas. So then they kind of build the story around these action sequences that they want to put in the movie. That's my big, and I'm jumping out of the 80s, but my biggest issue of the, I love the Mission Impossible franchise. That's one of my favorites, but I despise Mission Impossible 2. But I also know that there was no real script for that movie. Tom Cruise and the director, whatever his name is, that did Face Off, John Woo, like they started their meetings with what are the most ridiculous stunts we can think of, and then took those stunts they wanted to do and then tried to build a story around it, which is why the movie is so choppy. Well, it was also the original running time was like 3 hours long, so they had to cut a lot of, they cut all the story out to keep the action sequences, which makes it less enjoyable of a movie, in my opinion.
Yeah, I mean, we could go on a whole tangent about Mission Impossible or Fast and Furious or something like that. But, you know, the Indiana Jones, I feel like I hadn't thought of it until I was doing the research for this movie, but I do, the James Bond comparison, is, mm-hmm. it makes a lot more sense.
They
didn't try to build on the story and continue to. Temple of Doom is not related to Raiders of the Lost Ark, which is mm-hmm. not related to Last Crusade, which is not related. You know, I mean, I think Crystal Skull is the first time that you even have like a returning character.
Aside from, was it Marcus? Like Marcus returns in the third one. Yeah, this is the only one that does not have a recurring character at all. Because Marcus, you know, he worked from at the college.
Okay. Is in,
yeah. Yeah. And
that's right.
And John Reese Davies, Sala. I think Sala's in the third one as well. So they kind of brought back some characters in the third one, but this one is completely separate. Yeah.
But I mean, you can easily watch Last Crusade or Raiders of the Lost Ark and not.
Oh yeah,
like,
yeah.
They don't build off each other
no,
at all.
Yeah.
Where like if you tried to watch any of the Mission Impossible movies without watching, you know, well, you could probably skip two, but
yeah,
without watching the other ones, like you do get lost, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially the last couple. But yeah, you're right. But that was true. I want to say that you know it's been a while since I did that research, but I want to say like Indiana Jones was kind of birthed out of Spielberg wanting to make a James Bond movie, but knowing that they would never let him do one. So he kind of created his own version of James Bond of being like the archaeologist. But the is definitely an homage at the beginning of this one because he dresses in the tuxedo to look very much like a James Bond, right. Sean Connery James Bond. So it's definitely there. All right, you ready to jump into casting?
Sure, let's do it.
Okay. We won't talk much about Harrison Ford because, of course, he was in the first one. So I've talked about him previously. But I will say that he underwent a strict workout routine with trainer Jake Steinfeld, Body by Jake, consisting of weightlifting and calisthenics such as push-ups, sit-ups, pull-ups, and squats to prepare for the role. Spielberg also undertook the same routine to encourage Ford, but he quit after only a few weeks, which I thought was great. Harrison Ford also had a serious back injury in one of the fight scene in the bedroom in the temple, and he was laid out for several weeks. And so Spielberg actually had to film. He ended up filming the fight scene at the end on the rock crusher with the stunt double. He filmed all of that and then filmed the close-up shots of Harrison like 3 months later, or, you know, 6 or 7 weeks later after he recovered from surgery. So that was an interesting story I saw on the behind the scenes featurette on YouTube. All right. So let's talk about Kate Capshaw as Willie Scott. Capshaw moved to New York City to pursue her dream of acting, landing her first role in the soap opera The Edge of Night. She starred in Dreamscape in 1984 with Dennis Quaid and afterwards was directed by her then boyfriend Armian Bernstein in Windy City. She met film director and future husband Steven Spielberg upon winning the female lead as Willie Scott in this movie. In addition, she appeared in 1986 film Space Camp, followed by Power in 86 with Richard Gere and Gene Hackman, and then starred in The Quick and the Dead with Sam Elliott in 1987. She had several film roles throughout the late 80s into the 90s. She starred alongside Michael Douglas, Andy Garcia, and Black Rain in 89, Sean Connery and Lawrence Fishburne in Just Cause in 95, and Warren Beatty and Annette Bening in Love Affair in 1994. Believe it or not, Sharon Stone was the top choice for the role of Willie Scott before Kate Capshaw auditioned. Stone later starred in King Solomon's Mines in 85 and its sequel, Alan Quatermain and The Lost City of Gold in 86, two films that attempted to duplicate the success of Indiana Jones franchise. Also, Marky Post of Night Court fame was heavily considered for the role of Willie Scott as well.
I could have seen either one of them do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Willie Scott is not, like, that memorable of a character. Like, it just... Yeah, you know, I mean, I know that she's been somewhat critical of the role herself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I don't think she's as bad as what Kate Capshaw goes around saying about it. But, you know, there's definitely, like, Sharon Stone at the time, I think, could have done it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Like, you know, it's not like when we've talked about it in past episodes or even with Harrison Ford. Like, I would have a hard time seeing anyone other than Harrison Ford be Indiana Jones.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. You know? If you were to remake Temple of Doom, which you know is not a good idea, but if you were, like, I don't think the Willie Scott role is so like, oh my goodness, you can't. You know?
It wouldn't be hard to recast. Yeah, I would honestly. No. I think Marky Post would have been a good choice for that. Honestly, you know, maybe because I've seen King Solomon's Mines and Sharon Stone in that role, it's pretty terrible, but it's also pretty terrible. Knockoff of Indiana Jones too, so I guess those are similarities there. But Capshaw is not terrible, but the character just doesn't have much. I mean, she's and they said they wanted her to be completely different right. from Raven. I mean, from Karen Allen's character in the first one, who was very independent and like kind of an equal with Indiana Jones. Willie Scott is just the damsel in distress that screams through most of the movie. Like I forgot how much she screams in this movie until I was watching it and I was like, yeah. Gosh, is she going to scream in every single scene? which the rumor is she did not know how to scream until she made this movie. Like, Spielberg had to like teach her how to scream, at least the way he wanted her to scream for the movie, which is crazy.
You know what I was saying? Like, it's no, like, I'm not, no knocking on Kate Capshaw. No, yeah, her acting ability. Yeah. It's just, you know, this particular role is not necessarily well written, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen her in other roles where she's much better. She has a much more of a character to portray. And this one, she just, I mean, she does, she has a few shining moments that I will give her some credit for. And she probably brought some life, more life to the character than was probably on the page, I would think. Because especially you got to think if they were, if Lucas and Spielberg are, you know, heavily involved in the writing, both coming off, you know, bad relationships and divorces, they're not trying to give a strong female character, probably.
Probably not, no.
All right, well, moving on, we'll talk about a character that I'll love to talk about more. That's Kehu Wan as Short Round. Hopefully I'm not butchering his name. But as a child actor, he rose to fame, of course, playing Short Round in Indiana Jones in 84. And, of course, Data in Goonies in 85, following a few roles in the 90s like TV's Head of the Class and cult classic movie Encino Man with Brendan Fraser and Goonies co-star Sean Astin. He took an almost 20-year acting hiatus during which he worked as a stunt choreographer and assistant director. I had no idea that he worked as a stunt choreographer in Hollywood when he wasn't acting, which I think is awesome.
I think I had heard that only because when he did make his comeback, like, people were like, where's he been? He's like, well, he just wasn't acting, but he was still active.
You know? Yeah. And so speaking of that, he returned as an adult at the science fiction film Everything, Everywhere, All at Once in 2022, a performance which won him various accolades, including an Academy Award, a Golden Globe, and a Screen Actors Guild Award. He's one of two actors of Asian descent to win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor and the first Vietnam-born actor to win an Academy Award. Time magazine named him one of the 100 most influential people in the world in 2023. So good for him. Did you watch Everything Everywhere All at Once? Have you seen it?
I know that you didn't like it very much from your review that you put online. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah. I can't say that I didn't like it. It just wasn't, I didn't think it deserved as much of the praise as it was given. But I did like it. There were things that I liked in it. It was just, it was a little too weird for me.
I see, and that's where, like, I have a love for weird movies. I absolutely think it deserved all the praise that it got. I was actually given a copy on Blu-ray for my birthday.
Oh, very nice.
So, you know, like, I haven't watched it since I got it, but but I think that the people who won the awards all deserve the awards that they got. And it was nice to finally see a genre movie get recognition when they normally don't.
Yeah.
But I mean, it was so cool, like, watching the movie, like, going, man, I can't believe that's Short Round, or I can't believe that's Data.
Yeah.
Like, I think Data is probably the way I think of him most, because I've definitely seen Goonies way more than I've seen this one. You know, like, he's so iconic as Short Round with that wearing that Yankees hat. It's even though I know Goonies better, like, I still go, hey, that's Short Round. You know?
Yeah, those are two definitely super memorable roles. But yeah, I'm like you. Like, I probably know him more from Goonies because I've seen Goonies way more than this one. But there's still certain lines from this movie that are just emblazoned, like, you cheat, Dr. Jones, you cheat. You know, just like different things that he said, you know, his little one-liners and stuff, which is fun. And like I said, that iconic, the Yankees hat. And even when he's doing, like, he's doing the fight scenes, you know, he's doing some of those karate fight scenes, which they had a choreographer kind of helping him. But he was saying, like, he grew up watching Jackie Chan movies. So he was already, like, used to doing some of those kicks and stuff. And he just thought he was fooling around. And when he got with the stunt choreographer, he was like, oh, some of the stuff I'm doing is actually what I'm supposed to do. So it was kind of cool for him to do that. So which I thought was nice. It was an open casting call put out to all the elementary schools to find a young Asian actor to play Short Round. Kwan arrived with his brother, not to audition, but merely to provide moral support. He caught the casting director's attention because he spent the entire time of his brother's audition telling him what to do and what not to do. Steven Spielberg liked his personality, so he and Harrison Ford improvised the scene where Short Round accuses Indy of cheating during a card game, a scene they ended up putting in the movie because that's what they did during the audition. Kwan won the role over 6,000 other auditions. And last year, he said that he did not know who Harrison Ford was before he started filming Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. He had not seen Star Wars or Raiders of the Lost Ark until after they finished shooting Temple of Doom.
And that probably helped.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, how does it say how old he was? I might have missed that.
Yeah, I didn't put it in here. He was either like 10 or 11. I mean, he was fairly young.
So yeah, old enough to maybe understand who famous people were, but not necessarily old enough to truly get it. But, you know,
right.
I think had he seen those movies, it might have gotten, you know, either starstruck or maybe mm-hmm. a little bit more, you know, not quite the, you know, the performance that we got out of it.
Because, right, you know, right.
Like, it's really hard to get a child at that age to give the kind of performance that he gave.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, and not come off wooden.
Right.
You know, Jake Lloyd. you know.
Whew. Yeah, let's not go down that road.
He did a really good job as a child actor in this movie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. And I think he pretty much steals most of the scenes he's in as well. Like, he was a great addition to the cast, for sure. Those are the people that we probably know the best, but I will talk about two other actors that are not, we know them as the role for this, but they didn't do a whole lot of other things. But, and I'm hopefully I will not torture, you know, butcher these names, but I'm sure I will. Amrish Puri as Mola Ram, the priest who performs the human sacrifices. Puri acted in more than 400 films between 1967 and 2005, most of which were commercially successful, and was one of the most successful villains in Bollywood. He is known to international audiences for his roles, of course, in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, as well as Gandhi's Muslim employer and patron in South Africa in Gandhi from 1982. For this movie, he shaved his head, and it created such an impression that he kept his head shaved thereafter. His baldness gave him the flexibility to experiment with different looks as a villain in subsequent movies, and few are aware that in every film thereafter, he was wearing a wig. Puri and Spielberg shared a great rapport, and Spielberg often said in interviews, "Amrish is my favorite villain, the best the world has ever produced and ever will." So I thought that was pretty cool. But yeah, he's a good bad guy for sure. Good villain.
Yeah. I do try to watch foreign movies, but I don't get into Bollywood very much,
right,
at all.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So, not other than Mola Ram, I can't say I know him for, you know, anything else.
Yeah, no, it's the only thing I've ever seen him in. I've never watched Gandhi, so I wouldn't have recognized him in that either. But the character is named after an 18th century Indian painter. Lucas wanted Mola Ram to be terrifying, so the screenwriters added elements of Aztec and Hawaiian human sacrificers and European devil worship to the character. To create his headdress, makeup artist Tom Smith based the skull on a cowl, as this would be sacrilegious, and used a latex shrunken head for his headrest, which that makes sense. And then the other actor is Roshan Seth as Chatterlal, the prime minister of the Maharaja. He began his acting career in the early 60s in the UK, but left acting the following decade and moved to India to work as a journalist. In the 80s, he rose to prominence for his comeback performance in Gandhi as well, which brought him a BAFTA Award nomination for Best Actor in a Supporting Role and reignited his interest in acting. He has since appeared in numerous British and American feature films and television programs, with roles ranging in Passage of India, My Beautiful Laundrette, Mississippi Masala, and Street Fighter the Movie.
Oh.
So you didn't recognize him from Street Fighter?
No, I did. I try to forget that I saw that movie.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever. It's like I'll see it on the streaming things. I was like, you know, I don't know if I've ever seen this, but I don't feel like I want to watch it now either. So, so real quick, an uncredited Dan Aykroyd appears briefly and with a British accent as Weber who escorts Jones, Short Round, and Willie from their car to the plane, which I recognized him immediately and always forget that he's in this movie until he pops up. Did you recognize him?
Yeah, as soon as I saw him, I was like, yep, that's Dan Aykroyd.
Like, just hanging around London, thought he'd be in a movie with Steven Spielberg all of a sudden.
Well, and it's one of those things that's like because he's Dan Aykroyd, like, I kept waiting for him to come back into the movie.
Right.
And then just like, that's weird. Like,
because
it's not like Dan Aykroyd was a nobody when this movie came out. Yeah. So, yeah, exactly. You know, like that's somebody that everybody would have been like, hey, that's it. And then just never came back in the movie. Like,
nope. Just a little walk-on cameo. That's all he had to do. So my favorite little story about the cast is this. Actor Pat Roach plays the cult overseer in the mines with painted brown skin. He had previously appeared as the German mechanic, the giant Sherpa in Raiders of the Lost Ark. And he actually, I think he shows up again in Last Crusade. So he actually fights Indiana Jones in all three movies as a different thug, which I think is pretty fantastic.
Well, I mean, when you got something, you know, you're going to make it work for
exactly.
you.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. But like, Harrison's probably, well, I have to get beat up by this guy again. So anybody else from the cast that you wanted to mention that I might have forgotten about?
Well, there was no Taylor Negron or Vincent Trevally. No. So
none of our Better Off Dead alumni made it into this one. Amanda Wiss.
No.
John Cusack.
No, so I can't bring up any of those people. So no, the cast was, you know. Yeah. I mean, it's for having such a large cast, like, it really was basically just the three people.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
I didn't put his name down, but the leader of the village that tells them about the curse on the village. I can't remember his name. I didn't write it down, but a cool story was that he spoke absolutely no English whatsoever. And so to film those scenes, he was actually repeating the words that Steven Spielberg was saying to him. So he was saying his lines phonetically, not knowing what he was saying. And Spielberg even said, like, he was even giving him the motions of, like, what, you know, move his hand across his forehead when he says the dark cloud came over, whatever. And so if you'll notice, there's like breaks, like he has long pauses. And Spielberg was like, that's why those pauses are there, because I had to feed him the next lines for him to repeat. And so the editor had to, like, really work with that to make it seem a little more seamless, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, good for him. For giving it a shot.
Yeah. I mean, it works. I never would have thought that he didn't speak English. I would have thought that, you know, his English wasn't that terrible.
No, for somebody who apparently didn't speak it at all. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yep. All right. Well, let's jump into favorite or iconic scenes. I know there's going to be several in this one. So which iconic scene would you like to talk about first? As you unroll your notes.
One of my favorite scenes is one you already kind of briefly touched on.
Mm-hmm.
I love that when Indy and Short Round are playing poker and catch each other cheating.
Yes.
And like they're having this whole conversation. Like, and Willie is just freaking out the whole time.
Yeah.
And those two are just ignoring her.
Yeah.
Like like she is just going on a tangent about how terrible everything is, and she's screaming, and you know, she keeps coming across snakes and animals, and they're just, it's like they're in another room or like another building, like they're just not. I did really enjoy that scene.
Yeah, that is a fun, that's definitely a fun scene, a good little comedic scene before you get into all the, you know, dark elements of the movie. I do like the scene in that kind of at the little campground scene where the elephant keeps like bumping her and she's like, leave me alone. And then the snake comes down over her shoulder and she thinks it's the elephant trunk and then slings it over while Indy is completely freaking out because it's a snake, which I love that. I love that scene. That's always been one of my favorites. All right. What's your next iconic scene?
I mean, the minecart. I mean,
yeah. Yeah. That, and I'll say that's one of the scenes that rewatching it made me enjoy it more. It was like, I remember how fun that was seeing that as a kid. And like you said, I think maybe watching it now, the nostalgia part of it made it more enjoyable, more so than the movie as a whole, because it's still problematic in a lot of areas. But that scene specifically took me back to my childhood, even when it's kind of the POV of the tracks, like you're on a roller coaster. It was like, I want to throw my hands up in the living room like I was on the roller coaster, and just remember that feeling of being in the theater and seeing that, like, that was the coolest thing ever.
I mean, it's really the kind of the centerpiece of the movie. I mean, mm-hmm. the whole minecart chase scene, like, which, you know, let's not get into the problematic nature of like how ridiculous it is, but you know, the whole movie
is ridiculous. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, but it's what they kind of sell the movie on. I mean, it's mm-hmm. just, you know, is that whole minecart scene, which mm-hmm. is, you know, it's a lot of fun. You know, you can't go wrong. And if you want to have even more fun with actually playing it, try the Lego game.
That would be fun. Watching it, especially now with like better quality, it's easier to see the parts that are the miniatures for some of the scenes, which yeah. I think I remember like noticing when I was younger, but they're a little bit more pronounced now for the miniature scenes, which are still pretty fun. The cool thing is like the entire, like the live scenes of them on the actual track was just a circular track in one of the largest rooms they had in the studio. And so he said they just basically shot them doing the same kind of moves on the track. They would just change the lighting to make it look like it was a different part of the cave, which is pretty smart. You gotta give it to them.
Oh yeah. And you know, that's the thing about like watching something in 4K now, or, you know, mm-hmm. watching it, HD. You know, we've got these, HD 4K, all the thousand whistles, mm-hmm. you know, stuff that was made back in the 80s. Like, well, you know, like, you know, well, it was the only thing I can think of off the top of my head is like the coffee cup in Game of Thrones. You know, you go back right. and you watch the 80s movies, you see a lot more stuff like that. Boom mm-hmm. mics show up.
Yeah.
Stuff
yeah.
that I don't think we were ever actually meant to see.
Right, right.
But because, you know, back then we didn't think that people were going to rewatch movies or watch mm-hmm. them as carefully as we do now.
Right, right. Yeah. Freeze framing and, you know, the pause button on the VCR changed a lot of how movie was made after that, because realizing that you could rewind and rewatch a scene over and over again and catch unintentional or intentional mistakes or Easter eggs that the producers or movie makers wanted to do. So yeah, very much so. But yeah, that's definitely a fun scene. And you know, there are some effects that do look a little more cheesy now with the HD. The water coming through the mines is definitely a miniature, and them running in front of a screen of the water behind them. So that's pretty evident. And even the one where he pushes them into the other lane or something, that's like superimposed on the screen, was pretty noticeable as well. There are a few scenes like that, I think.
Yeah. Let's see, what else do I got here? Pulling the heart out mm-hmm. and then the guy staying alive. I mean, I can't think, that's another one that's yeah, the minecart scene, that scene are pretty heavily parodied.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but like mm-hmm. yeah, the whole om om shabai, and then he pulls the heart out. And
right.
The guy stays alive. And it's like, wait a minute. I mean, that guy's literally holding his beating heart. How right. are you still?
Right. And then the heart turns to flame once the body goes into the flames. Like, that's, you know, all the mystical, magical stuff. But then, of course, the bridge scene is pretty iconic too.
Yeah, I got that. I got that one down too.
Yeah. Which is, that's one of my favorite scenes too. I always like that scene. And then it's just cool watching that bridge break and watching it fall on both sides was pretty cool. And they got that on one, they had to do that in one take to do.
Yeah. Something like that, you really don't get a second chance at. You know?
Yeah. I'm probably jumping into trivia that I have later, but Steven Spielberg is deathly afraid of heights. So when they built, like, they had, so I think they filmed in Sri Lanka because they weren't allowed to film in India. So where they were close to filming, there was actually like a university or a company, like a corporation that was into physics. And so they were able to get them to come and actually build that actual bridge for them like 200 feet off the ground. So it wasn't as high as on the movie, but it was still pretty high off the ground. So it was like very sound. Steven Spielberg said he could only go out about a third of the way on the bridge on either side. And that was as far as he could go. But Harrison Ford would run back and forth on the bridge just to drive Steven Spielberg crazy, which I thought was pretty hilarious. So on the behind the scenes featurette, they actually have footage of you watch Harrison running across the bridge, which is pretty cool.
My mom's deeply and deathly afraid of rope bridges or suspension mm-hmm. bridges.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister and I are not. So as a family, whenever we ended up doing hiking or trips where we were, mm-hmm. we would get on either side of mom and really kind of
like move shake the yeah. Yeah. So oh, yeah, yeah.
Move the bridge. Yeah. We thought that was funny. I mean, it probably still is, but yeah. I get where Harrison Ford's coming from. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk about the dinner scene. I think the dinner scene is probably another one of the most iconic scenes of the movie as well. You were probably older when you saw it. If you saw it in the '90s, did it gross you out when you saw it the first time?
Yes and no. I mean, it's one of those things like it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So like, I know it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So like, it's hard for me to get like too squeamish about it. Cause I know it's all special effects and
right,
you
know, right.
Like none of it's real, mm-hmm. but yeah, the idea of like if I was at a dinner and somebody brought out a giant wriggling snake and I was like, "Ooh, it's snake surprise."
Mm-hmm.
And then cut it open. It was just, you know, more snakes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not afraid of snakes, but I'm not saying I'd take that well.
Right. Right. Yeah, the chilled monkey the brains, soup. The eyeball soup. Yeah,
yeah. Although I will say the cockroach.
Yeah,
maybe because it's HD, looks so fake. Like the other stuff, at least was somewhat realistic.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that cockroach or the scarab, whatever it was mm-hmm. supposed to be, just really, really the HD nature of the TV just really took away from the realism of that one. So probably toned down the grossness.
Yeah, yeah. So of course they got a lot of flack for that scene. That was all Lucas and Spielberg, and they kept adding to it. Like, let's make it even more gross and make it, but they were trying to they wanted it to be seen as funny. Like, they thought it was going to play as a funny scene. Like, oh my gosh, it's so ridiculous that they would cut open a snake, or oh, that it's monkey brains. Like, they thought it was, they were trying to do it as a comedy bit, but it didn't really play that way in the movie the way they thought it would. And they said, looking back on it, they kind of regret some of the things they did in it. And even in, the Indian culture, Indian government, first of all, wouldn't allow the movie to be shown for a long time in their country. But they were upset because they felt like that was not a accurate representation of the kind of food they ate. And even like the Indian actors that we mentioned earlier, they were like, but it's a fantasy. They're like, you should know. And this was a direct quote. He's like, you should know if you see three people survive jumping out of a plane on an air raft and surviving, that anything that happens after that cannot be real. So it was like, I thought it was interesting because like thinking as a kid, like, I didn't see that as a comedy. I mean, it was kind of funny, like her reactions to it, that was right. The comedy part of it. But I did as a kid think like, oh, that must be really what they eat over there. Like that would have been my thought process. So I don't think it played on the comedy the way they thought it would. I think the comedy was her reaction, not, oh, how ridiculous is this food they're bringing out? Because it's a different culture. We just thought that's what they eat over there.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought that. I mean, it's possible I did. It's hard to get back into the mindset of the
mm-hmm.
the 12 to 14 year old I was when I saw this movie.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it's also hard for me to understand why George Lucas and Steven Spielberg thought that scene was
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I guess you're right. Like their reactions are her reactions.
Mm-hmm.
Like when he was like, "Ooh, cockroach!" And like, like they are the over the topness of like the guys,
mm-hmm.
Matched mm-hmm. with her, just like horrified, like
right.
You're right. I mean, it is kind of like, but I don't really understand how it's supposed to be comedy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I want to kind of go back and watch the scene now with that, look at it through that mindset and kind of see, try to maybe see it in a different way. But it's still an iconic scene. I definitely want, you know, it needed to be discussed for sure. So any other favorite scenes or iconic scenes?
There was that fight scene in the hotel or the bedroom
mm-hmm.
where I did write that must be the most powerful fan ever.
Yeah.
As somebody who has installed many ceiling fans in his life, I don't think there's one of them that I've ever installed that would be powerful enough to hang a guy.
Mm-hmm. A big guy at that, you know, that wasn't a yeah. small guy he was fighting either.
Right.
Yeah.
And then I also wrote, it was shortly after that when they were going through the catacombs and mm-hmm. Andy was like, don't touch. And he immediately touched.
Yes. Like, yes. That's that was going to say, like, another one of my favorite scenes is that scene in the spiked room that starts to come down on them, which I think was a lot of fun.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, and the, you know, the obvious throwback to, you know, the first one, and then they do it. I think they do it in all of them.
Mm-hmm.
Where you happen to reach back under and pull the hat out.
Yep. I like that. I like that scene a lot. And I think it's funny too. And I think Spielberg even said, like, that was one of his favorite scenes to film. But he said that originally, like, they came up with the idea while they were shooting it for when she comes in for her to hit the piece with her butt and it start all over again and them trying to run out. He said, and Spielberg talked about it, he said that Lucas really wanted to keep it dark. Like, he wanted to be as dark as possible. And Spielberg was the one that kept trying to throw in comedy bits to lighten things up. And he said that was one of the ones that he felt was, that was one of his things of lightening up the mood or the moments of, you know, it starting back up again and them having to run out, him grabbing the hat, which then became, like I said, they've done in all the other, every other sequel at that point. Anything else?
Yeah. I mean, there's the one line that I think most people quote that it's almost a throwaway line way earlier in the movie than I thought. No time for love, Dr. Jones.
Yeah. Yep. Yep.
I hear that line parodied a lot on various things. And it's like, wait, that happens like 5 minutes into the movie? Or
mm-hmm.
ten minutes into the movie?
And now these messages.
What's up, dudes? I'm Jerry D of Totally Rad Christmas, the podcast that talks all things Christmas in the 80s. Toys, movies, specials, music, books, fashion, and fads.
If it was gnarly during Christmas in the 80s, he's got it covered. Wait, is there a lot of things to talk about for the 80s and Christmas?
Well, you got the movie giants like Christmas Vacation, Scrooged, and A Christmas Story. There are TV specials like Muppet Family Christmas, Claymation Christmas Celebration, and a Garfield Christmas special.
Plus classics shown every year.
You also jam out to Last Christmas, Do They Know It's Christmas, and Christmas in Hollis. But most of all, it was a time for the most bodacious, best-selling Christmas toys ever, like He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers...
And Cabbage Patch Kids.
Yes, them too. We cover them all, plus much more, including standard segments like Hap Hap Happiest Memory, Gag Me with the Spoon, The Other Half of the Battle...
And Chant with the Littles.
So tune in to Totally Rad Christmas everywhere you get your podcasts. Turn the clock back and dive into those warm and fuzzy memories.
Later, dudes.
Hey, everybody. Do you ever just sit around with your friends and reminisce about the days and how things used to be when you were a kid or a teenager or maybe even a young adult? The TV shows and the movies that you watched at the time and how things just aren't quite the same today? Well, let me tell you, I've got the place for you. My name is Chris Adams, and I'm the host of the podcast Retro Life for You. And here at Retro Life for You, we talk about and discuss movies and TV that is retro. And we are going back from the 80s and the 90s and into the 2000s. Hey, sometimes we might even touch back to the 70s if we're feeling good. If this is for you, make sure you look for us on everywhere that you can find your podcast at. Spotify, iTunes, Amazon, Google, Stitcher. We're hosted on Anchor FM. And make sure you follow us on all the major networks and leave us a rating and a review. It really does help. Look forward to hearing from you.
All right, well, let's jump into some trivia scenes and or trivia and maybe think of some other scenes. I think some of these I've kind of already talked about. because they're talking about that scene with the spiked room, the bug chamber sequence. Kate Capshaw was really covered with over 2,000 insects. She actually had to take sedatives prior to the scene just to get over her initial fear, but she claimed they definitely worked. Somebody took the time to get this the stat for you, but Willie Scott screams a grand total of 71 times throughout the movie.
Which is a lot, considering it's barely a two-hour movie.
Right. I think that's probably 70 times too many times that she screamed in that movie.
Yeah.
This is a funny story. I don't know how true this is, but I had to share this one. So while filming the whipping scene where Indiana Jones being whipped before he gets brainwashed, the crew played a practical joke on Harrison Ford. While he was chained to a large stone, Barbara Streisand appeared dressed in a leather dominatrix outfit. She proceeded to whip him, saying, "That's for Hanover Street, the worst movie I ever saw," which is the movie he was in 1979. She continued whipping him for making Star Wars and making all of that money, quote unquote. Carrie Fisher showed up for some reason and threw herself in front of Ford to protect him. And Irvin Kershner chided director Steven Spielberg, saying, "Is this how you run your movies?" Supposedly this entire sequence was filmed, even though it's not been released to the public.
I'm kind of surprised it hasn't been. It would right. be funny. It would oh, be funny yeah. to see it.
Yeah.
I mean,
Barbara Streisand in a dominatrix suit.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to see that part of it, but I would like to see the scene, you know, just because it would be funny.
Many fans have expressed thoughts regarding Jones and his friend's choice to go back into the mines instead of leaving through the palace with the rest of the escaped captives, which I kind of didn't think about that till I read this. An explanatory scene was shot showing Indy and Willie helping the freed children cross the lava pit over a makeshift bridge. When the time comes for Short Round to cross the pit, the bridge has caught fire under the intense heat, and Indy and Willie manage to save him in the nick of time from falling into the lava pit. With the bridge crumbling, the trio has to find another way out, and that is through the mines. The most logical explanation for this cut seems to be the pace and not the film's running time, since it ended up at an hour and 53 minutes. Even the addition of all the scenes mentioned in this writing would not have pushed the film over the two-hour barrier. But I will say there was a thing that I don't think I have it written here either, is when they did the first edit of the movie, they realized it was too fast. And that's weird to hear, because most of the time things are cut because it's too slow.
Right. But
like the last 45 minutes of this movie is pretty much like nonstop action. Like it's moving very quickly. So I could see how they may have had to, you know, cut some stuff because it was just to adjust the pacing somewhat, or just too much action crammed into that amount of time.
Yeah, but that scene would have, I think, added to the movie and maybe,
yeah.
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how, I know Spielberg is very hesitant to go back and cut his movies or do mm-hmm. director's cut after he made some mistakes with E.T. Mm-hmm. So I don't know, but it would be interesting to see if they would go back, even if that footage still exists. I mean, most of that stuff, you know, hit the cutting room floor and then disappeared for time and eternity. But it would be nice to maybe do a director's cut one of these days,
yeah,
where some of that stuff gets put back in. But
yeah, or even just lost footage to put in to a deleted scene or something would be nice to see. Because I'm sure, yeah, I don't know, that would be a good scene to see. I mean, obviously it was a good suspenseful moment, which does, you know, make a little bit more sense, because I didn't really think about it. I think because maybe it's a thing because the action is moving so fast, you don't have time to think about why didn't they go with the kids. The kids went that way, they went this way. But
yeah,
I don't know. All right, and then I'm going to end this part with this quote from Steven Spielberg about the movie. In 1989, he said, quote, "I wasn't happy with Temple of Doom at all. It was too dark, too subterranean, and much too horrific. I thought it out-poltered Poltergeist. There's not an ounce of my own personal feeling in Temple of Doom." He later added during the making of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom documentary, he said, "Temple of Doom is my least favorite of the trilogy. I look back and I say, well, the greatest thing that I got out of that was I met Kate Capshaw. We married years later, and that to me was the reason I was fated to make Temple of Doom." So that's interesting that he's kind of, you know, he's kind of said that's his least favorite of the trilogies. I know that's my feeling as well.
I would I'd like to know like when that interview was done in relation to Crystal Skull.
Way before that. That was 89.
Okay, yeah. So I'd like to know like now. Because I know he's not doing Dial of Destiny, which
right.
You know, which will be coming out shortly. I don't know. It would be interesting to see. Now that it's on Disney Plus, maybe I need to rewatch it and give it another try. See if it really is as bad as I remember it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I've actually, because I remember I bought the DVD when it came out because I had the set that I have is just the three. And then when the new one came out, I was like, well, I want to complete my set. So I bought it and I have watched it a few times and it's like, I enjoy it up until the very end. It's like the ending just loses me when it becomes the extraterrestrial, you know, spaceship buried or whatever. That's when I just like, okay, you lost me at the end.
Yeah,
but I'll definitely go back and watch it. Cause I'm going to go back and watch Last Crusade. Cause that is my favorite of the three.
Absolutely. I mean, it is of the ones that we've got so far.
Mm-hmm.
It seems that, you know, the odd numbers, 1 and 3 are good, 2 and 4, not so good. So there's hope for 5.
Right, right.
But, you know, I don't know. We'll see.
I'm going in with very
cautiously optimistic.
Yeah, that's the word I'm going with, cautiously optimistic. It's like, I'm not going to be so hyped for it, but I hope that it's good.
Yeah.
I at least hope that it redeems itself from Crystal Skull. All right. Well, box office, let's talk about it. So Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was released in American theaters on Wednesday, May 23rd, 1984, just before Memorial Day weekend. It debuted at number one with no real competition from other new releases. It did unseat Robert Redford's The Natural, which had held the top spot the week before. Yeah, it was a big hit. It was definitely more of a financial success than a critical success because it did not do very well with the critics when it first came out. I think it's gotten better over the years, but the initial reviews were not as good. So Rotten Tomato has it at 76 on the tomato meter with an 82% audience score. And IMDb is a 7.5 out of 10 with viewers and a 57 on Metacritic.
Man, Metacritic, I don't. I'm kind of surprised that the audience that high on
Rotten Tomatoes. I've had the same thought.
And it's actually kind of surprising that it's that high on IMDb as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I would, man, I'd probably give it more like a 6.5,
mm-hmm.
7 maybe.
Yeah, I'm leaning like right at 7. 7.5 was a little too much for me, but I would give it a 7. Probably.
Yeah.
6.9 to 7 in that range. But 57 is definitely too low. But like I said, I think I definitely enjoyed it more watching it this time than the last few times I watched it.
I did have one thing that caught me this time that I somehow never paid attention to before.
Mm-hmm.
So Mola Ram, the big bad, the
film, yes. Mm-hmm.
Doesn't show up in the movie
mm-hmm.
until over an hour.
Yeah.
Of a movie that's just shy of 2 hours. So mm-hmm. like, yeah. And then like, for that matter, he's not even really in it that much.
Mm-mm.
Like, but did you catch, and this is probably when I haven't seen it for a long time, is the music when they were introducing or having, you know, Mola Ram show up for the first time. I know that John Williams did the score mm-hmm. of this. Very Duel of Fates from Phantom Menace.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I definitely caught some of the same. I was like, I mean, no, granted, I mean, I'm not knocking John Williams by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. But, you know, and I guess maybe because, you know, you only have so many chords, you only have so many notes that everything kind of starts to sound the same after mm-hmm. a while. But,
mm-hmm.
I mean, when you listen to Jurassic Park, you listen to Star Wars, you listen to Indiana Superman. Jones, you know, Superman, you know, like it all kind of similar,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
you know, but yeah, I definitely, you know, that scene where Darth Maul shows up and the scene where Mola Ram show up is, you know, they definitely, you know, they're related. That music, like you can tell.
So his villains' themes are very similar amongst the
At least those two are.
Those two, yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Yeah, I didn't pick up on it, but I'll definitely check it out next time I watch it for sure.
And then they kept talking about the cults, you know, the cult of Thuggy.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was like, I get to thinking and I go on rabbit holes I was like, is that a real thing?
Mm-hmm.
And it is like, it's a real cult. It's a real group. And it's not so much a cult that is a group or, you know, but that is where we get the English language word thug from.
Oh, really? I did not know that.
Because I went down the rabbit hole of just what, like, I got away from, like, what's going on in the movie into mm-hmm. what's going on with this cult, because it was really fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, I was like, you know, and it never dawned on me until Saturday night when I was rewatching the movie that is why we have the word thug. Like, because of thuggy the thuggy cult. We have the thuggy cult that existed long before probably the English language, but
wow, that's good. Yeah, I almost dove into that, but I didn't, and so I'm glad you did. So that's good to know. I tried not to use the word because I knew I was like, is it thuggy or is it thuggy? I was like, I'll just not use the word at all and just call it the cult. But yeah,
I thought they said thuggy in the movie.
They might have, but I couldn't remember if they did or not.
But because we have the word thug, and it's a word that we use, you know, fairly regularly. Mm-hmm. I feel confident in calling it the thuggy cult.
Sure. It works for me. I think we've covered this one pretty well.
I think we have as well. Yep.
Yeah. Good deal. All right, man, Nicholas, thank you so much for joining. I've enjoyed, I'm still catching up on my podcast, but you're currently in your Who Played It Better series. It's about to move into the bracket now, right?
Oh, we just put out part one of the bracket.
Okay.
Yeah, I had only intended on doing the three parts.
Mm-hmm.
But like any good series, we just, you know, once you get into a series, you got to stretch it. You just got to keep going, you know.
Right. Yeah,
at some point, I'll figure out how to go to space and really just jump the shark entirely.
There you go.
With the franchise. But until then,
mm-hmm.
So we just put out part one. But by the time this comes out, I think we might have part two out, the final bracket.
Okay.
I don't know how much longer I can stretch, how much more taffy I can pull out of that topic. But, you know, it's right. been a lot of fun so far. So why stop now?
Yeah, I made it through the DC bracket. So that was, or not bracket, but the DC episode about it. So, or no, did I do Marvel? Was it Marvel or DC?
Well, we went the others, then Marvel, then DC. So,
oh, I did Marvel. So, yeah, I did others and Marvel. So, I haven't listened to the DC one yet. So, that's where I'm at, and I'm trying to catch up on a lot of different podcasts right now. I'm way behind, but yeah, definitely check out Pop Culture Roulette with Nicholas and the guys. Let them hear them nerd out on their multiple topics that they love to talk about, which usually turns into some kind of bracket. I think we're becoming kind of the bracket podcast at this point.
Yeah. If we can figure out how to make a bracket out of it, we probably will.
Very cool. Well, thanks everybody for listening. Be sure to follow, subscribe, rate, review the podcast. You can always support the show through buymeacoffee.com. And of course you can buy a t-shirt or a sweatshirt from the website. 80sflickflashback.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who loves 80s flicks. And also, you can follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, and TikTok. Nicholas, thanks again, man, for being here. Always a pleasure to have you. You'll be back. We're going to cover Lethal Weapon 2 during the summer of sequels, so be looking for that one coming out this summer as well.
Looking forward to it.
Yes, sir. All right, everybody. I'm Tim Williams for the 80s Flick Flashback Podcast. Good night, good people.
You're still here? It's over. Go home. Go.